From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. We are watching to see what comes from the meeting at the White House this afternoon with President Trump and top congressional leaders in both parties. This as the government shutdown is in day 12. The White House is rejecting the latest offer from Democrats to fully fund the government, but not the border wall that the president is insisting on.
And Democrats take control of the House tomorrow. Over in the Senate, Vice President Mike Pence will do the swearing-in, including of Utah's newly minted Republican Senator Mitt Romney, who wrote that scathing Washington Post op-ed on President Trump, saying he has not risen to the mantle of the office. So that could be awkward. Let's bring in our political strategist roundtable, the Republican this week, Alice Stewart. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Robin. Great to see you.
You too. And the Democrat Bill, well, here. And
the Democrat, here.
Yeah, the Democrat Bill Press, who hosts the Bill Press radio show. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Robin. Hi, Lisa. Happy New Year.
So, hey. Same to both of you. Yeah. And Bill, I want to start with you and ask about the talk that the Republican Lindsey Graham has been floating, a pathway for citizenship for DACA recipients, the people brought illegally into the country as children before a certain date. In exchange for the president's funding for the wall, Politico is now saying that Democrats are completely rejecting that. What would you advise? Doesn't that make the Democrats look like they're not willing to compromise, get something they really want, like that path to citizenship?
No, I don't think so at all. First of all, the Democrats did, and it's not just Democrats, but there was a plan the last time we talked, actually, just before Christmas, where the Senate Republicans and Democrats had passed a plan with $1.6 billion. The House said they would go along with that plan. At that day, the White House told us that they were going to support that plan. And then the Freedom Caucus met with Donald Trump and they said, we don't like this. So he changed his mind and said, we're going to have a shutdown. So to tie the Dreamers to this now, I think it's just a little too much too late. This is all Donald Trump shut down. And the question is how long he's going to continue his temper tantrum, I think, because he didn't get what he wanted for Christmas.
Alice, I want your thoughts on this. But first, we spoke with the Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern, the Democrat who's about to take charge of the Rules Committee in the House. And here's what he said about that idea of accepting this deal that's floating around.
We ought not be blackmailed into providing protection. And that's what the president has tried to do in the past. And I think some are suggesting he do it again in the future.
Alice, your thoughts?
I think trying to find some kind of consensus and agree on this issue is not blackmail. That is a bipartisan cooperation on a very important issue that the Democrats want, but quite frankly, Americans want. We have almost 7 in 10 Americans do want some type of protections for Dreamers. And I've said all along that that is a bargaining chip that I feel the Democrats could be using and have tried to use. I wish the president had accepted the opportunity when he had the first meeting with Chuck and Nancy to incorporate that in the conversation, and he could come down off his $5 billion. They could come up on their $1.3 billion. But I'm encouraged to hear Lindsey Graham floating this idea. I hope it is part of the conversation. But at this stage of the game, clearly Democrats feel it's not in their best interest, or they don't have any incentive or motivation to further this conversation, and they're going to take this all the way taking over in the House, because it will certainly be a much different situation when they have control in the House.
By the way, which will be tomorrow. I just want to add one point. I find this whole conversation, not just us here on Here and Now, but in the general, in the media, to be really lacking one major element, which is this whole debate should not be taking place in the first place, because Donald Trump said, I'm going to build a wall and Mexico is going to pay for it. Now, he's already broken that part of the promise. So now we're debating how much money American taxpayers are going to put up for this wall.
Well,
Mexico
is
supposed to be paying for this wall.
Well, he says it is. There's a tweet that the president issued this morning that says Mexico is paying for the wall through the new trade deal. Much of the wall has already been fully renovated or built. So we know that.
That's just not true. That's just frankly not true.
It's not true because it has not been renovated or built.
I do agree with Bill on that point. Once we realized Mexico was not going to pay for the wall, it put this in a whole new dynamic, and I'm not a supporter of give me a hamburger today, I'll gladly pay you on Tuesday with regard to Mexico nice. Paying
who
for
was
themselves.
That guy? Who was that guy who said that? Wimpy. Sorry.
Yes.
Go ahead.
It puts this whole conversation in a different context when Americans are paying for a campaign promise. That being said, border security is something that both sides should be able to agree on, and both sides standing in their corners with their arm crossed is not going to get the work done that we need to get done, which is border security.
But the fact is, I just want to come back to this. If this bill, which passed the Senate once, were put up tomorrow, it would pass the House. It would pass the Senate again. The only problem is Donald Trump will not sign it. And Mitch McConnell, who has abdicated all of his leadership, has said, I will not even ask a vote for anything that the president will not say ahead of time that he would sign. So who's the leader of the Senate today? Donald Trump.
Well, we have to point out that Democrats, there have been deals in which Democrats were offered the path for citizenship, but they felt it didn't go far enough. So we just have to say that. But I want to get to the Mitt Romney op-ed in the Washington Post, shall we? You know, scathing of the president, saying he's just, you know, not deserving of the office. Trump tweeted out, I won big. He didn't. He should be happy for all Republicans, be a team player and win. Alice, what's happening here? Is this Mitt Romney running for president?
This is him. He loves op-eds. This is how he communicates his message. And he wanted to just make clear that this is character is important and character is a valuable asset for elected officials and specifically the president. And he clearly just wanted to get that out there. I expect and fully anticipate him to vote fully in line with the president because they do share the same policies, but their tone and tenor and the character are two totally separate pages.
Do you expect him to run for president? Is this an opening volley?
It wouldn't surprise me, but he's got a difficult time because it's not a secret that the Republican Party is fully behind Donald Trump at this point. And it will be a very uphill battle. But he certainly opened the door for that opportunity with this op-ed.
And Bill, should independents and Democrats maybe leaning away from Elizabeth Warren, we'll talk about her in a second, should they be worried about somebody like a Donald Trump Mitt Romney, who is presenting himself as a moderate and somebody who's, you know, with more civility?
I think they should be hoping that somebody would run in the Republican primary against Donald Trump. But I don't think it's going to be Mitt Romney. I think it's one and done for Mitt. But we wondered who was going to be the new Jeff Flake or the new Bob Corker. And I think it's going to be Mitt Romney in the sense that he will be critical, but he'll vote for everything Donald Trump wants.
Yeah. Let's talk about Senator Elizabeth Warren then. She announced a presidential exploratory committee this week, pivoting away from questions about Donald Trump.
I think the central part of winning this is to get out and talk with people about what we're fighting for. We want a government that works not just for the rich and the powerful. We want a government that works for everyone.
Bill, in terms of her message and her appeal, who do you think it does appeal to?
I think it appeals to the broad base of Democrats. I think it's the right message for 2020. I'm not sure yet that Elizabeth Warren is the best person to deliver that message, frankly.
Why not?
Only because, first of all, I think she should have run in 2016. I'm not sure she's done much to broaden her support and base in the time since. And there are 29 other Democrats, by my count, who are going to be running. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to be interesting, and maybe as many as 8 other senators running. So she's just the first of many, and I think we're going to have to see how it all plays out.
I agree. 2016, in my view, was her time to really step in there. If you look at where we were 4 years ago, it was Clinton Warren with regard to where they stood in the favorability ratings for Democratic candidates. And this time she is fourth behind Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Beto O'Rourke, and then Elizabeth Warren. That was her window of opportunity. I applaud her for jumping out there, getting her name out there and running on the issues. I just feel as though the Democratic Party is looking for a young, fresh face, and I don't see her as being that.
Alice, I just have to ask you, the minute and a half we have, this week President Trump tweeted that he's slowing down his announced troop withdrawal from Syria after hearing, you know, concerns about, you know, his just announcing this. apparently without talking about it with anyone. He's also missing a Secretary of Defense. He's got a sub, but not the main person, and he's missing a chief of staff. Do you worry about a president that we hear is increasingly isolated, angry, throwing out these stink bombs, these lobs, without people around him?
I am encouraged by the fact that Lindsey Graham was able to sit him down and slow this fast train to nowhere. I'm encouraged by that. Clearly, we've always known President Trump to be someone who speaks first and then maybe asks questions later. He's clearly doing that as well this time. But I'm encouraged by the fact that he realized, and he got a lot of criticism by Republicans and national security officials that reminded him this is not a good idea. Senator Tom Cotton was very vocal about his concerns about this quick withdrawal, and I'm glad to see that he's rethinking it and asking the important questions.
And I got to say, I am worried that all the generals are gone, generals that we thought could keep Donald Trump in check, and I think the only general left is General Chaos.
Bill Press, Alice Stewart, thank you.
Thank you.
This past July, Florence, Italy hosted an international sporting event. About 3,500 athletes from more than a dozen countries came to town. They were easy to spot.
Well, you saw a lot of pink shirts because we're famous for our pink fuchsia shirts.
Athletes, including Jane Frost, are all breast cancer survivors, and their sport? Dragon boat racing. So what's the connection between an ancient Chinese competition and breast cancer? Martin Kessler from NPR's Only a Game has a story for us.
A good place to start is the year 1994, when Dr. Susan Harris, a physical therapist and professor at the University of British Columbia, was diagnosed with breast cancer. After her surgery and before she started radiation, Dr. Harris went home to visit her family.
And it was a beautiful autumn day, so I was raking leaves and just putting the specter of cancer behind me for a bit.
After the trip, Dr. Harris went to see her own physical therapist back in Vancouver.
She said, "How was your holiday?" And I said, "Oh, it was great. I raked leaves with my family." And she said, "What? Repetitive upper body motion. That's terrible. Let me measure your arm."
Dr. Harris soon learned what women diagnosed with breast cancer had long been told, that repetitive upper body motion, even raking leaves, could cause a condition called lymphedema, a swelling that's relatively common in the arms of breast cancer survivors who have had lymph nodes removed.
And unfortunately, it's generally irreversible and can lead to other more serious conditions such as cellulitis.
Dr. Harris started thinking about all the things she'd no longer be able to do, not just raking leaves, but playing tennis. She says another patient was told she could no longer cut vegetables.
And I thought, this is going to wreck my life.
But soon Dr. Harris started reviewing the medical literature on exercise and lymphedema, and she became skeptical. Around that same time, one of Dr. Harris's colleagues at the University of British Columbia, or UBC, was also starting to question this supposed connection between exercise and lymphedema.
My name's Don McKenzie.
McKenzie is a sports medicine physician and an exercise physiologist. He was and still is a physician for Canada's national canoe team. Dr. McKenzie had been unaware of the prevailing wisdom on exercise and lymphedema until one day in 1995 when he tried to prescribe some upper body exercise to a female patient.
And she said to me, "Well, I can't do those." And I said, "Well, yeah, I'm pretty sure you can. They're pretty simple. I can show them to you again." And she said, "Oh, no, you don't understand. I'm not allowed to do those because I've had breast cancer." So I went into the medical literature and found out that there were no studies that proved that if you do this type of training or use your arm in this fashion, it's going to create this swelling. So I decided, well, let's challenge the myth.
And Dr. McKenzie thought, what could be a better, more visible way of challenging the myth than having a bunch of breast cancer survivors paddling canoes? But they couldn't use the same kind of canoes that you see in the Olympics.
I wasn't going to put people into the flat water or sprint racing boats that are really tippy. The most stable craft that we have in the canoeing world is actually a dragon boat.
Dragon boat racing is believed to have started 2,000 years ago in China. It's since spread all over the world. The boats are long. They normally hold 20 paddlers, each with one oar, sitting two by two, plus a steersperson and a drummer to keep everyone in sync. So a dragon boat made sense, but that meant that Dr. McKenzie would need 24 breast cancer survivors who were willing to go against prevailing medical wisdom.
I had a number of people question this project and say, are you sure you want to do this? You know, you've got 24 women that you've recruited that volunteered to be there. What if a bunch of them get lymphedema? Then what?
But Dr. McKenzie believed in the project, and he had one crucial colleague who did too, Dr. Susan Harris, the UBC physical therapist who'd been told to stop raking leaves. And not only would Dr. Harris come on as a researcher, she was also going to paddle on the Dragon Boat team.
I started to tell the women in my support group, so I was able to infect enthusiasm in other women as well.
At that same time, Jane Frost from Vancouver was celebrating 10 years of being cancer-free. Her only paddling experience came from a few outings in a little rowboat.
I wasn't an athlete at all.
But when she heard about this Dr. McKenzie at UBC who was looking for volunteers, she decided to show up to the first meeting.
They came out, and I showed them, a video of a group of paddlers called the False Creek Women. And the False Creek Women are internationally famous. They're world champions, but that was the only video I had.
Oh my goodness. Many of us had never even seen a picture of a dragon boat, let alone a competition at that level. And he told us that's what we were going to be able to do one day.
And what did you think of that?
Well, we were terrified.
But Frost and the other women stuck around. And because the doctors had said before, don't lift heavy weights, don't do repetitive motions, was there any nervousness just as far as what you were doing for your health?
Yes, there was, but most people had faith in Dawn, so we overcame that. We've overcome a lot of obstacles.
The plan was for the project to last 6 months. They'd start with a few months of training in the gym, then a few months on water. Dr. Susan Harris and another physical therapist would take arm measurements throughout. And the team, they named it A Breast in a Boat, would row in a dragon boat festival that spring in Vancouver.
If they did that and didn't develop lymphedema, well, that would be a strong message.
The project began. Here's Dr. Harris again.
I remember doing my first lat pull, the pull down of the bar above your head, and I started at a light weight of about 40 pounds, and I pulled down and I looked over at my arm to make sure it was okay.
No need to play up the suspense. At the end of the project, none of the paddlers had developed lymphedema.
From my perspective, a hugely positive finding.
I mean, I was really excited because A, we had just had a ball, and B, we could say, for starters, that maybe this was safe.
In June of 1996, the first breast cancer survivor dragon boat team entered a competition.
We got into the boat for our first race, and we were pretty scared.
That's Jane Frost again.
And we all thought we were going to die before we got to the finish line. But when we hit the finish line, we had thousands of people cheering for us. It was remarkable.
One of Frost's friends came over to her.
Gave me a big hug, and she said, I'll bet this is the first time you've ever broken out in a sweat, Jane. And she was right.
Dr. McKenzie says A Breast in a Boat started getting a lot of media attention.
So I was really happy that we were getting the message out. But I also thought, well, okay, well, that's the end of that project.
Dr. McKenzie laughs now because he quickly learned that Frost and the team had a different plan.
I canvassed all our paddlers to see if they wanted to carry on, and to a person they said yes. So then I just approached him, and he didn't really have much of a choice, to be honest. He got us into this. He has to carry on.
In 2000, Dr. Harris and a colleague published the results from A Breast in a Boat's first season in a journal for surgical oncology. Dr. McKenzie and others followed up with additional studies that came to the same conclusion. But how exactly did we get to the global breast cancer survivor dragon boat phenomenon we have today? To answer that question, I have to tell you about a woman named Sandy Smith.
She joined our boat in the second year, 1997, and she was quite quiet, but she was brave. She had a wonderful stroke. She was a beautiful paddler. We all vied to sit behind her.
I'd say, well, if you want to look at how it's supposed to be done on the water, have a look at Sandy Smith.
Dragon boat teams were springing up in Victoria and Montreal, and more women from around the world were reaching out about forming their own teams. Someone in Vancouver needed to take the lead on helping out.
So we asked Sandy if she would take it on, and she was very enthusiastic.
Smith became the first global liaison, spreading the sport and the message that breast cancer survivors can exercise around the world.
She did an awful lot to kind of bring this to the global space that it's in today.
And then in 2002, she got sick again. And we all rallied around, but sadly she died. We talk about our fallen angels, the ones who have gone, and there's a lot of them. It's very hard. That's the hardest part of this, is watching people have recurrences and being with them.
Not long after Sandy Smith died in 2005, the first International Breast Cancer Survivor Dragon Boat Festival was held in Vancouver. Smith's teammates came up with a plan to honor her with a race, but it wasn't going to be a regular race. Instead of pitting teams from around the world against each other, all the boats would be made up of paddlers from different teams and countries. The Sandy Smith Global Finale is held at all the international festivals, including this past summer's event in Florence.
That's truly international, and that's where the Sandy Smith race belongs.
Of the 24 original members of A Breast in a Boat, 22 are still alive. Dr. Susan Harris published another article in 2012, which reviewed research showing that not only is exercise safe for breast cancer survivors, it can actually reduce rates of recurrence, too. She still plays tennis and feels safe cutting vegetables. Dr. Don McKenzie has continued to research cancer and exercise, and he still travels around the world, spreading the message that exercise should be a part of treatment for women who've had breast cancer. As for Jane Frost, she helped found and became the first president of the International Breast Cancer Paddlers Commission. As she stood on the bank of the Arno River in Florence, Italy this past summer, she took a moment to observe the movement she helped inspire.
We really felt this phenomena of all being in the same boat. We'll all paddle together. We cried a lot and we laughed a lot, and we continue to do that. And I got quite emotional looking at the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of women who had all been active and were fit and good paddlers and happy. And I was pretty proud.
For Here and Now, I'm Martin Kessler.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your shortlist of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Netflix has pulled an episode of a comedy show that criticized Saudi Arabia's role in the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. In comedian Hasan Minhaj's show, The Patriot Act, he calls out Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for allegedly ordering the death of Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. A warning, this clip from that episode uses offensive language.
It blows my mind that it took the killing of a Washington Post journalist for everyone to go, oh, I guess he's really not a reformer. Meanwhile, every Muslim person you know was like, yeah, no, he's the crown prince of Saudi Arabia.
Now, it was the CIA that concluded that bin Salman ordered a group of Saudis to fly to Turkey in October and kill Khashoggi and then cover up his death. Saudi officials deny the crown prince ordered the killing and threatened legal action against Netflix under a Saudi anti-cybercrime law. So let's bring in WBUR's Callum Borchers, who's been following this story. Hi, Callum.
Hi, Robin.
It's so fascinating, you know, what control does Saudi Arabia have over Netflix? So they pulled the episode in Saudi Arabia. It is available in other places around the world. So talk about this legal threat that convinced Netflix to cave there, and what does this mean?
Well, Saudi Arabia sent a letter to Netflix citing a law that prohibits, quote, material impinging on public order, religious values, and public morals. Now, that's very broad, mm-hmm. Robin. I mean, it basically means the government can censor anything that they don't like. And what's striking to me is that the whole episode reinforces the point that Hasan Minhaj was making in that clip that you just played. You know, mm-hmm. it puts the lie to the idea that Mohammed bin Salman was going to be a reformer. And meanwhile, you have Minhaj, who raised his profile here in the U.S. by criticizing our government at the White House Correspondents' Dinner just a couple of years ago. And when he takes a similar jab at the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, he gets yanked from that country.
Well, let's talk about the reaction. Jamal Khashoggi's former editor at the Washington Post, Karen Atiyah, tweeted, "It's quite outrageous that Netflix pulled the episode. Social media is calling out Netflix for bowing to censorship." So what is Netflix, and what does Minaj say about that?
Well, you know, Netflix has suggested as well that it really had no choice. You know, it said that it received a valid legal request from Saudi Arabia. I'd say the counter to that is, you know, the Guardian newspaper has pointed out that the punishment for violating this law in question is a fine of about $800,000 or up to 5 years in prison. So, I mean, that $800,000 is chump change for Netflix. And as far as the imprisonment, there is no way Saudi Arabia was going to be able to extradite and imprison Hasan Minhaj in this scenario. So yeah. I think it's reasonable to wonder whether perhaps they could have stood up to Saudi Arabia and called their bluff.
Well, they've been a hit in Saudi Arabia. So there may be a business decision there. Shows like Marvel's Iron Fist, House of Cards, very popular there. Just very briefly, got a minute. Other tech companies that have Saudi investments, Uber, Lyft, Slack, have any of them broken ties yet?
Not completely. You know, some of the companies did pull out of that big Saudi investment conference back in October. But the longer-term business calculation of really everyone has been that the business ties to Saudi Arabia are just too valuable to cut. And the irony is that was actually part of Minaj's comedy routine, too. So here's Netflix producing a show where Hasan Minhaj slams companies for not standing up to Saudi Arabia, and then Netflix doesn't really stand up to Saudi Arabia.
Oops. Colin Borges, senior innovation reporter at WBUR, our mothership. Colin, thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
On day 12 of the government shutdown, America's national parks are feeling the impact. Many of them have stayed open, but they don't have the staff there to enforce rules, collect entrance fees, and even clean the bathrooms. In some parks, volunteers have stepped in to help. That has happened at Joshua Tree National Park in Southern California. Joshua Tree includes parts of the Mojave Desert and a number of mountain ranges. John Loretic has been coordinating volunteers there. He's a retired park ranger and now heads the nonprofit Friends of Joshua Tree National Park. John, would you, if you can, give us a ground report on the park today?
Yes, I've been into the park at least a dozen times over the past 10 days or so. And, you know, things are okay, but the longer this shutdown goes down, the more the park needs its real maintenance people in there to do their jobs. Right now here in the high desert, we are trying to stem the tide, so to speak, and try and keeping the bathrooms as clean as we can keep them and the trash bins as empty as we can. With the amount of visitation we have right now over the holidays, tens of thousands of people pour into the park, and the day-to-day maintenance in those bathrooms needs to happen. And we've come together and have done that and are ready to do it as long as this shutdown continues.
How have members of the community come to the fore? What specifically have they been doing?
Well, for folks that are not able to come up into the park and help us, they've been donating money and materials. We have one of the local outfitter shops, Nomad Adventures, as a repository for people to drop off supplies, whether it's trash bags, toilet paper, gloves, cleaning supplies. And then every morning at 10 o'clock, we meet up, we distribute those supplies and send folks out to different parts of the park to sweep up, clean up, and restock the pit toilets that are all up in the park.
And are these people mostly those like yourself who have worked at the park in the past?
No, I don't think so. I've been getting messages from people who are visiting the park on vacation saying they want to help out. But there's a lot of local folks, too, that just love Joshua Tree National Park and the high desert itself and want to keep the park as clean and as great as it is today, tomorrow, and in the future.
We spoke with someone who was volunteering briefly yesterday, Bonnie Hawthorne, who said that a lot of people who were going to the park as visitors were going out on the trails with their dogs, and that is not allowed because the dogs scare wildlife in the parks. Are most of the infringements that you are witnessing people who mean any harm to the park, or is this just more people kind of not knowing the rules and nobody being there to enforce them?
That's a great question. I think most of the folks just don't know the rules. The national parks run on special rules and regulations. They're trying to preserve their areas for future generations. Most of the folks in the park, 99%, are doing just what they need to do. But with this volume of people we have in the park, traffic is a problem, parking is a problem. I've heard of some vandalism. I haven't seen any. But the longer this shutdown goes down, the more at risk our cultural and natural resources are in the park.
So you're worried about long-term damage. For those who haven't been to Joshua Tree National Park, is there anything in particular about what's there that you think is particularly vulnerable?
I think we have cultural history of peoples using this land for thousands of years. So we have rock art and pottery charts and all kinds of different historic evidence of people living in the past. We also have a rich mining history, and there's plenty of mining sites with all kinds of historic features in those mining sites too. So, and some of those are remote, and so you can't really check them on a daily basis. But I'm just hoping that now, with no or minimal law enforcement presence, that those sites are just remaining just the way they are.
John, have you gone out yourself as a retired law enforcement ranger to check out particular parts of the park, and either been more dismayed or less once you've been out there?
That's a great question. With the holidays, the visitation in the park is just—it's phenomenal. There's people parking everywhere. So I've seen this kind of visitation before, and I'm actually surprised at the minimal amount of damage or minimal amount of problems that are happening in the park. But, you know, it doesn't take but one person to drive off-road into the desert, and then that desert is scarred for years to come. The desert just doesn't recover quickly.
How concerned are you, I wonder, about other national properties around the country?
I'm very concerned because Joshua Tree has some historic artifacts in the park and things like that, but there's other parks that have just a gold mine of artifacts and resources that are basically unprotected right now. And I would hate to see those pieces of our history and heritage disappear during this shutdown. So if folks can come together and volunteer for their federal lands that are in distress right now, in need of help, that would be great if they could come together in a community effort and support their parks, whether it's cleaning bathrooms or just checking on these valuable one-of-a-kind sites that all these parks hold.
That's John Loretig, executive director of the nonprofit Friends of Joshua Tree National Park. Thanks very much, John.
Thank you, Lisa.
Let's get a bigger picture now. John Garter is senior budget director of the nonprofit National Parks Conservation Association, which is an advocacy group that is aimed at protecting the national parks. Welcome, John.
Thank you for having me.
So we were hearing there about what's happening at Joshua Tree Park and the concerns over whether there might be long-term damage because of the shutdown. What are you hearing from parks around the country? Is that a common concern, and what particular challenges are you hearing about?
It is a common concern. There are a number of parks that are actually closed outright, but at a lot of parks we're seeing the same kind of damage at Joshua Tree at varying levels of scale. So overflowing trash bins, human waste in inappropriate places, altercations over parking spots, and other impacts that we fear are a threat to visitor and wildlife safety, as well as the protection of the natural and cultural resources for which these places were designated.
And where in particular are the bulk of the problems happening?
We're seeing impacts at Shenandoah, at Grand Canyon, at the parks in the Southwest, at Yosemite, and a number of other parks.
Why did those parks stay open, by the way? If some have shut down, would it be better to avoid any kind of human interaction at all during the shutdown?
Unlike the 16-day shutdown in 2013, this administration elected to take an approach that would allow for partial closures of a number of parks.
And in your view, do you think it would be a better idea for all parks to close during the shutdown?
Well, the best thing would be for all parks to open entirely with decision makers coming to an agreement. It's really not a situation that should have happened to begin with.
Christmas and New Year's are, of course, very big times for vacationers to go to national parks across the country. But this year, the parks are apparently doing away with entrance fees. There are no entrance fees that they're bringing in, so a lack of income must be a concern. How much revenue are the national parks losing?
Our estimate is that the park system is losing somewhere in the order of $400,000 a day. So when you do the math, it's over $4 million that they've lost so far. And that's money that they really need.
Money that they really need because they have been shorthanded anyway. I know Rangers across the board pretty much have been demoralized because of the lack of staff to be able to keep the parks in the shape they'd like.
Rangers are, of course, very demoralized right now because they want to be in the parks serving visitors and protecting them. But they're coming into this situation where they are already challenged. Over the last several years, we've seen an 11% reduction in Park Service staff due to underfunding. But at the same time, there's been a 19% increase in visitation.
Have you heard from any of your colleagues or have you yourself been out in any of the parks to see what's happening during the shutdown?
A lot of my colleagues have been in parks as well as talking to parks friends groups that support them. One colleague of mine at the Grand Canyon observed that the park concessioner was having difficulty keeping up with plowing the roads, which was creating a dangerous situation. And while he was there, there was an accident with a truck going off the road and hitting a car.
And the volunteers, such as the one that we just heard from before we spoke with you, to what extent are they making a dent in what's happening?
We really commend the volunteers who've been helping to try to take care of parks and make sure that visitors have a safe and enjoyable time. The problem is that it's a really unsustainable situation and unfair to ask them to use their limited resources to step in to try to serve the role of the Park Service.
All right. Nice to talk to you. Thank you very much, John Garter, Senior Budget Director of the nonprofit National Parks Conservation Association. Thank you again.
Thanks, Lisa.
And now let's join Mr. Peabody and his boy Sherman for a time trip in the Wayback Machine. That's a Rocky and Bullwinkle reference, but anywho, today we're headed to the 1960s and 70s when a group of educators and students undertook an experiment in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. For some, it was an attempt at utopia, but for others, mostly outsiders, it was an unwelcome outpost for the counterculture of the time. New Hampshire Public Radio's Robert Garova takes us back to Franconia College, the state's liberal arts sanctuary that's all but lost to time.
Open house.
Rain clouds are just starting to roll in over the White Mountains near Franconia, New Hampshire, and Chris Brooks is leading me through saplings and overgrown grass. We're trying to find a trace of the buildings that once stood here.
It's almost hallucinogenic when I come in here.
Really?
Because it doesn't look like anything I remember.
Brooks spent about 8 years of his life at this spot, first as a student and later as a teacher at what was then known as Franconia College. The school attracted about 400 students at its height.
Where would have been the building? There's this great, you know, picture of all the college kids.
Sitting on the roof in the balcony?
Yeah.
And the portico there?
Yeah.
That was the main building. That's what I've been trying to find for you.
The story goes, the town of Franconia wanted to do something with a decaying old hotel called the Forest Hills. The once popular resort was starting to become a bit of an embarrassment. So town leaders decided to turn it into a college. Students helped fix up the place and attended class in rooms filled with leftover hotel furniture.
It was Hippieville, and we disdained all forms of formality and conventionality.
There were co-ed dormitories and organic gardens. Students had representation in educational policy decisions. They built their own dormitories and radio stations. But most of that is long gone now. There isn't even a marker to let passersby know what was here.
This was a beacon for everything that was happening in the 60s. History vanished and we became, simply for a few years, Franconia College. Not really bound by time or space, just its own unusual entity.
Just like the music from that era, I think Franconia was an optimistic response to a very threatening time.
Keith Talbot was a student at Franconia College in the 1960s. He went on to work at NPR, where he pioneered a new kind of radio. He says that work was inspired, in some ways, by the intersectional education he got at Franconia.
Franconia was like, wow. an entirely new interpretation of the world, and it seemed like that was sorely needed at that point. The war raging. Most kids were there to get away from that world, to examine that world, maybe even to create a better world.
This has turned out to be a very important college, a very important situation in American movement towards art and literature. Amazing, it is.
Peter Bradley is an artist. He's also known for organizing what's considered one of America's first racially integrated art exhibitions. and he taught painting at Franconia College in the early 70s. Bradley says it was Leon Botstein, then president of Franconia and current head of Bard College, who gave him the job. He says Franconia was a special place.
I felt all energy because of the atmosphere and the climate. It was unreal. The winters were incredible.
For several people I spoke with, the seclusion, the dark nights, and the freedom were a welcome respite to the turmoil of the time. The battle for civil rights in America, race tensions, the Vietnam War. Students felt they could regain control of their lives, at least for a little while, at Franconia. By the late 60s, though, people outside the boundaries of campus began to voice concerns about how students and faculty were affecting the area. Former student Keith Talbot recorded part of a community meeting from 1968. In the scratchy audio, you can hear the college president at the time describe a conversation with 10 members of the Franconia Chamber of Commerce who were signaling they wanted the college to close.
We were asked some questions. The questions had to do with bare feet. Students who smell bad because they don't bathe often enough. Long hair. And certainly the whole aura of moral degradation was strong.
Talbot and other students had come to Franconia to escape the turmoil of the time, but they couldn't keep the world at bay forever. Back at the site of the former college, Chris Brooks remembers what he calls the beginning of the end for the school. State police conducted a raid on the campus, and then the New Hampshire paper The Union Leader ran a story.
And it's a famous headline, you can see it online, "Bear Debauchery at Franconia College."
But below the Franconia news, there was another headline, this one having to do with the national news of April 5th, 1968.
It's a noted civil rights leader slain, Martin Luther King's assassination. It's on the same front page.
The college continued on, and so did the negative press. There was more pushback from local officials and financial trouble. Franconia eventually closed its doors in 1978.
Now it's passed on to the realm of the mythological.
There is a Facebook group, though, where Brooks keeps up with fellow alumni and faculty. Most physical remnants have long since rotted away. But Brooks never left New Hampshire, and others didn't either. Former students would go on to become state senators, open local bookshops, and found companies that still exist in the Franconia area. Brooks says Franconia College gave a sleepy town with a past, a future. For Here and Now, I'm Robert Garoba.
Fascinating. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now.